Well, it has a lot of downsides. Maybe there are two answers to that. One is it has downsides, and the other are kind of what are the alternatives and how can we get to the alternatives?
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, my conversation with Richard Berfalt of Columbia Law School. He's an expert on redistricting, gerrymandering, voting rights, and election law. We know New York State is going to lose one member of its House delegation when congressional lines are redrawn for the 2022 elections following the 2020 census. What we don't know yet is how the new lines will look. But New York's Independent Redistricting Commission was unable to avoid partisan divides earlier this month, releasing two opposing maps to redesign congressional and state districts, one backed by Democrats, the other backed by Republicans. Similar processes are taking place in all 50 states. So we talk about this every 10 years. Has redistricting always run up against partisan impulses?
I think the short answer to that is yes. It's always been a political process. There are some legal constraints on it, but I think it's fair to say it's always been a partisan process.
And how does that play out typically?
Well, I mean, what you've got is in around the country, state legislatures. In a few states, there are independent commissions, but for the most part, you have state legislatures drawing lines for their state's congressional delegations and also for the state legislatures themselves. So the legislators are, in effect, writing the rules that will govern their own future elections or re-election, as well as the possibilities from themselves if they want to run for Congress or for their party in Congress. So there's a kind of a natural tendency to take into account partisan consequences and even more personal ones, such as whether the district is good for the individual member, might even possibly as a way of repelling a potential primary challenge.
This is the system that we've had, since the United States came into being. Is it necessarily bad to do it this way?
Well, it has a lot of downsides. Maybe there are two answers to that. One is it has downsides, and the other are kind of what are the alternatives and how can we get to the alternatives? I mean, the downside is obviously it provides an incentive and a possibility for entrenchment for the party that currently dominates the legislature to write lines in such a way that favors their party even more, that makes it harder for them to be challenged, that it increases their majority beyond what it would get in a fair set of lines and kind of overstates their power. So that's the built-in downside of having somebody write the rules in effect for themselves. There are alternatives. There, a number of states now have what are true independent redistricting commissions, where through a process of selection of how the members get chosen, they are relatively independent of the political process. A number of states have also adopted in their constitutions more clear-cut rules that are designed to limit partisan influence, and occasionally those actually get enforced in court. So the principal alternatives would be to move the process entirely out of the legislature into an independent commission, and the struggle there, the trick there, is how to make that commission really independent. And then the second would be to keep the process in the legislature, but to have more aggressive judicial review, to at least put on some guardrails and to limit the ability of the current majority in the legislature to favor itself.
Are there guidelines that are just too partisan? You know, if you cross over that, then the courts tend to throw the maps out. I mean, I'm thinking of past high-profile cases like in Texas. But what have courts been saying in regard to redistricting in recent years?
Well, sir, there are three kinds of issues. One is about population, and that's the Supreme Court's famous intervention in the 1960s in the one-person, one-vote cases. So there is now a requirement for congressional districts and for state legislative districts and for local districts, for that matter, of relatively equal population. The districts have to be pretty close to the same population size, and that has been regularly enforced by the courts. A second set of concerns involves racial discrimination, drawing lines in such a way as to disadvantage voters of color. And that has also been policed by the courts. There are some debates as to what the best way to draw, which lines do disadvantage minority voters, but at least there are legal rules that limit the ability to use line drawing in a way that dilutes the influence of voters of color. The third issue has been partisanship and the ability of legislators to draw lines that disproportionately favor their own party. And that the Supreme Court just a couple of years ago declined to take that on and said that that matter is non-justiciable, meaning it's not fit for judicial resolution. And so the court has said, we don't like partisan gerrymandering, but we're not going to step in. As the Supreme Court has said, we don't like partisan gerrymandering, but we're not going to police it. A handful of state Supreme Courts have said that they or have struck down state line drawing as excessively partisan under state constitutional provisions. But as a matter of federal constitutional law, the Supreme Court has said the federal courts at least are going to stay out.
Let's apply point three to New York State. You and I are both in New York. We have a nominal independent redistricting commission drawing the lines this time, although we know that if the lawmakers, you know, can't accept the lines, they'll draw the lines themselves. And Democrats have supermajorities in both houses of the legislature. And the new governor, Kathy Hochul, has said publicly that, you know, Democrats will draw the maps to their advantage if they have the ability to do so. What's your reaction to that? Because there are way more Democrats than Republicans in New York State. Is this just, you know, the winners taking the spoils?
Well, it's a little too early to tell how it's going to play out. As you say, we're literally in the middle of that process. So a few years ago, the voters amended the state constitution to actually create this commission. Up until now, the redistricting was done entirely by the state legislature directly without even any kind of separate body, and often done without any kind of public hearings or done entirely behind closed doors with the majority of each chamber of the legislature doing it for themselves. And then until recently, we had a Republican state Senate and a Democratic assembly, and that had been the case for many decades. So the Senate would be done by Republicans, the assembly would be done by Democrats, and then they would strike a deal, essentially, for the congressional districts. Now, really, for the first time in a very, very long time, if ever, actually, the Democrats now are in charge of both houses at a time when we're doing redistricting. So that certainly changes the situation. But as I said a couple of years ago, the voters did adopt a number of amendments to the state constitution that both put in some standards in the constitution to guide districting, including protection of against minority vote dilution, protection for so-called communities of interest, and a kind of a prohibition on kind of excessive attention to party or efforts to drive out a particular candidate to sort of unduly influence a particular election, and then also set up the so-called independent redistricting commission. It's not that independent compared to commissions in some other states. Eight of the 10 members are directly appointed by the state legislative leadership, Democrats and Republicans, and then those eight then appoint the remaining two. So it is, I'd say, one step removed from direct legislative action, but it is not totally independent. And then, as you point out, they don't have the power of law. They can present a plan or plans. They can't enact the plan. The plan has to go to the legislature, which under this the process the Constitution set up, legislature is required to consider it, doesn't have to adopt it. If the legislature rejects the commission's plan, the commission can come back with a second plan. The legislature has to consider that one also, and then the commission even gets a third bite at the apple to see whether they can come up with a plan that satisfies the legislature. But in the end, it is up to the legislature. And as you point out, the legislature is required to act with supermajorities. That was designed to make sure that one party couldn't totally control the process. But right now, it is possible that limit won't preclude the Democrats from totally controlling the process, especially since there's going to be a constitutional amendment on the ballot this coming November that many people aren't aware of, which will lower the threshold for the supermajority in each house of the state legislature from two-thirds to 60%. And right now, the Democrats easily have 60% in both chambers of the legislature.
Do you think it's a good idea to have a higher number of House districts in the U.S.? Would that solve some of these problems?
No. I mean, I'm not sure about that larger number. I understand the point of that. The number of districts hasn't changed in almost a century. And, of course, the country is probably double in population what it was when those, or maybe more so than when the 435 number was set. The countervailing point is at some point it gets hard to – the bigger you make a body, the harder it is to manage it. So 435 is already pretty big. It could be bigger. I think the House of Commons in Britain is, 600, 700, 800 members. Even the Canadian Parliament is in the 300s, and that country is one-tenth the size of the United States. So I don't know that there's a perfect number, but that would be the downside. But even then, you'd still have districting. Think about it this way. If, let's say, the House of Representatives was the same size as if you added together all the lower houses of the state legislatures across the country, it would be some enormous body. But many of those lower houses from much smaller districts are still engaged in gerrymandering. So there's a case for a bigger house in that each representative, right now each representative is representing about 800,000 people. There's a case for making that number smaller, but that would not do much of anything to deal with gerrymandering.
So we've talked about establishing the lines ahead of 2022. A related issue is how people will be allowed to vote and where they will be allowed to vote. And Democrats have been beating the drum on this issue during this particular Congress following the 2020 election. What concerns do you see about the state of voting rights in America right now?
Frankly, the state of voting rights in America now is hanging by a thread in many states. I mean, the states write the laws that determine the voting process. I mean, the background constitutional norms are basically every adult resident citizen who hasn't been convicted of a felony has the right to vote. But the states sort of set the procedural rules, what you need to do to actually make that right real, the process for registering, whether you need to present voter ID, if there's going to be early voting, how many days and what hours. If there's going to be vote by mail, what do you need to do to apply for that? Do you need to submit ID with your mail application? Do you need to get that notarized? There's a whole bunch of really, really small details which can have the effect of making it harder for some people to vote. And what you're seeing remarkably in a number of states, not every state, I mean, in some states are actually moving to make it easier to vote. But what you're seeing in the states that are getting the most controversy lately, states like Georgia and Texas, are the states seem to be purposefully making it harder for people to vote. In many ways, these are restrictions which they anticipate will be particularly burdensome for voters of color, and I think they think for Democrats. So you're seeing a lot of what happened last year in many states was kind of a miracle in the way in which the system responded to the pandemic by making it dramatically easier for people to vote so that they didn't, particularly early or by mail, so that it didn't have to come to crowded polling places where they were afraid of infection. So you had a lot of creativity in the electoral system, and in many ways the last election was a triumph of the ability of the system to handle high levels of participation in all new ways. But perversely, that has inspired a lot of states to say, well, that was too much. There was a little bit too much democracy last year, so we want to make it harder. And that's what seems to be happening in many states around the country. Again, not every state, not New York, which is actually making voting easier, but in places like Georgia and Texas, which have gotten the most in the news.
And a lot of Republicans who decided to contest the Electoral College certification said that those states had acted unconstitutionally in expanding, mail-in ballots and that sort of thing that you've just mentioned, in a way, you know, raising doubt about the outcome.
Right. There's, of course, no support for that. I mean, they were not acting unconstitutionally. The only argument was that in some ways they were going, it may be fair to say that sometimes they were going beyond the law on the books in terms of, or sometimes they did it by law, actually. Some places actually did adopt new laws. But there was a relatively kind of rapid move to make voting easier. And there's nothing unconstitutional about that, quite the opposite. But their argument is not enough guardrails were put in to protect against fraud. There's, of course, as you know, the election was heavily litigated. There were well over 50 court decisions in the month or two after Election Day, and not a single court found any fraud above the most trivial amounts, and some didn't find any fraud at all. So this whole fraud thing seems to be totally invented as a way of justifying limits on the vote going forward.
Just one more thing. There were some worries and some strong hints in the California recall election that the eventual loser of the race, Mr. Elder, would not accept the results and would just say, you know, it was rigged. He said as much on the trail leading up to the election day. Do you worry about lasting damage of the norm of, you know, conceding defeat, accepting the results that Donald Trump established in 2020? Is there lasting damage from that?
I mean, it's a little too soon to tell, but it certainly seems pretty bad right now. I mean, you do have a significant chunk of the country believing that the last election was shot through with fraud and that Biden wasn't properly elected. That just simply can't be good for the system. It can't be good for a country built on the consent of the people, for the people to think that their consent was forged or that was not proper. So it just can't be good. How serious it is, how much do a lot of people really think there was fraud, really think the election was stolen? I don't know. But it's anything that, I mean, that undermines faith in the workings of the system without justification is simply is bad for self-government.
That's Columbia Law School professor Richard Brefault, an expert in redistricting, gerrymandering, voting rights, and election law. Thank you so much for being with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
All right, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.